Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Anthony Painter. I'm director of the RSA's Action and Research Centre, and I'm delighted to welcome you all here today. Before we begin, can I ask you to turn your mobile phones to silent? We're filming today and live streaming over the web, so a very big welcome to those of you joining us online, and a reminder that our hashtag is hashtag RSAFOA, if you'd like to get involved in the discussion on Twitter. Now, housekeeping notices over, it's my great pleasure to introduce today's special guest speaker, Frank Foer. Frank has been called one of America's most influential liberal journalists. He's a national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine and a fellow at the New America Foundation. In fact, we had Anne-Marie Slaughter here from the New America Foundation a few months ago. He edited the New Republic magazine for 7 years and is author of the award-winning How Football Explains the World. And you mean football rather than soccer, or soccer rather than football. It's few. And it's been translated into 27 languages, and clearly I'm looking forward to reading it. He joins us today to share some of the thinking from his new book, World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. The book is a wake-up call to all of us to stop and reflect on how rapidly four giant technology companies have come to encroach upon almost every aspect of our daily lives. It feels that we're increasingly living in a digital society where human relations are mediated by digital technology. So have we, as Frank argues, traded privacy, freedom of thought, freedom of will even, for what he calls an intoxicating level of daily convenience? And if so, are there steps we can take to reclaim our private authority and to rebalance our economy and politics? So there's big questions for us to tackle today, and an area that's of special interest for the RSA as we embark on new projects looking at how we can apply technology more ethically and for the benefit of the common good, while seeking out ways to ensure that tech and networks are harnessed to radically redistribute power rather than monopolize it. So it's a really great pleasure to have the chance to be able to explore these issues with Frank today. After his opening talk and our follow-up chat, there, of course, will be time for us to involve you all in the conversation too, before we wrap up at 2 p.m. But for now, let's get started, and please join me in welcoming Frank Foer.
Thank you so much. So this book did begin in a very personal sort of way for me. And part of it has to do with something that I'm sure is incredibly familiar to every person, probably nearly every person in this room. Maybe there's a virtuous few among us who don't feel this way, which is the relationship that one has to one's phone. I shudder to think at how many times a day I look at my phone. When my phone is in another room, it feels as if my arm has been severed, and it's just, I find myself physiologically beckoned by the phone. I've been known, and I'm ashamed to admit it, to sleep with my phone. And there's that experience where the phone buzzes in the middle of the night, and you find yourself, your circadian rhythm's completely interrupted, and you find yourself trapped in an endless scroll, and you can't. And this is so much a part of modern life, where you find yourself trapped in that endless scroll, and you the hours simply fade away from one of you. And it's not an accident that this happens. These technologies have been reverse engineered in order to steal your attention. There's an analogy that I make in the book, which is to food. That these technologies have been created in the same sort of way that a bag of Doritos was created. That we, 50 years ago, we had this advent of processed foods and television dinners, and they seemed so incredible in the moment. And then we woke up 50 years later, and we realized that for all the convenience that we got from these foods, they'd been reverse engineered to make us fat, and they'd addicted us, and they disrupted the entire process of creating agriculture, the distribution of food. And the argument that I make in this book is that something similar is happening to the things that we ingest through our mind. And so I set out to study Silicon Valley in an outsider sort of way. I'd had an insider sort of experience with Silicon Valley in that when I was editing the New Republic magazine, my boss had been Mark Zuckerberg's roommate in college, Facebook employee number three. And he was 28 years old when I first met him and worth $700 million. You hate him already. I went through this experience with him, which I'm sure we'll get into a little bit later, where in a very short period of time, we had to transform a little magazine that had been committed to policy ideas, to high seriousness in a very old-fashioned sort of way, writings about high culture. And in a very short span of time, we had to reinvent ourselves as a magazine that would flourish on Facebook. And to flourish on Facebook, I'll just pause for a moment to talk about Facebook because it illustrates so much of the core of the problem when it comes to these companies. Facebook is a giant feedback loop. Facebook takes data. Data is everywhere you've traveled on the internet. It's everything that you've read. It's everything that you've consumed. It's your friends, et cetera, et cetera. And it adds up to a fairly comprehensive picture of the inside of your brain. It's an X-ray of your soul. And so Facebook leverages this information that they have about you, which is in some ways more information than you have about yourself. And they take that information, this history of your habits and predilections, and then they reverse engineer your newsfeed in order to get as much of your engagement as possible, in order to get as much of your attention as possible. And so Facebook knows your pleasure points and your anxieties. And the information in Facebook is not randomly splayed across a page. It's a feed. It's fed to you in a way where it's organized in order to keep you involved as much as possible. And in politics, we've seen the ways in which this is just atrocious for our democracy, because it's very dangerous to be fed political information that confirms your biases, that plays to the anxieties that they know will keep you coming back for more. And there's a term that's been used to describe this, which is that Facebook—it's a filter bubble that Facebook's algorithms carefully nurture. And so at the New Republic, we had to go through this compressed period of media history where we had to rush to embrace the ethos of Facebook. Because if you want revenue in media, you need traffic. And if you want traffic, you need to create things that will flourish on Facebook. And at the New Republic, the worst thing, when I started in journalism at the New Republic, the worst thing you could say about a piece was that it was conventional wisdom, that it was an unoriginal idea. And at the New Republic, we prided ourselves to a fault on being heterodox. And with Facebook, the logic is that you leverage as much data as you have about your readers or about users, about what's worked in the past, in order to try to latch yourself onto the thing that's trending, that's on the upward slope of popularity. And you have various tools that help you chart your way to popularity. There was one set of tools that that almost every journalist uses, at least in the United States, called Chartbeat. And if you go into the newsroom of, say, the Washington Post, there are screens that hover over the newsroom that show what pieces are popular at any given moment. And I had on my phone this flickering chart. It's called Chartbeat. And so I could see at any moment how popular my pieces were. And if you weren't terribly popular in high school, it's like it's a rush. Because you could see, and I would wake up in the morning, and I would take out my phone, and I would immediately go to Chartbeat to see if people were liking us. And then I would check it again when I was getting coffee a few minutes later, and so on during the day. And this was a sea change for me in my life, that suddenly my mind was thinking in a different sort of way. I was looking, as opposed to looking for the counter-conventional wisdom thing, I was looking to repeat the formula that had worked in the past, because I needed to win for financial reasons, and as a human being, it was human nature to try to want to win in that sort of way. And so I found myself Whereas before, we had published articles that very intentionally, very self-consciously, we were publishing articles that we knew our readers wouldn't like because they were published from the left, or they were published from the right, or they're published from the center, or maybe they were just liberal positions that were aiming to skewer some sort of sacred cow. And instead, I found myself gravitating in the direction of trying to provide readers with exactly what they wanted. We ended up producing an echo chamber, an Amen corner, and in politics, this is extremely dangerous because it diminishes the quality of conversation, and we can see with Facebook the way in which it's diminished the quality of information that citizens need in order to make the very important decisions that we entrust them with every couple years. So in my book, I tried to study the Silicon Valley mindset. I tried to write an intellectual history of technology, as well as showing the dangers of our dependence on it. And what I found was I spent a lot of time on YouTube trying to just listen to Larry Page, the founder of Google, or Mark Zuckerberg, the founder of Facebook, to just listen to what they said. Because if you read the tech press, you get this, you can find out what they said about the latest gadget that's been released and how fine the quality is of the latest camera that comes on a phone. But what I found was when I listened to them, they said profoundly interesting things about human nature. That these companies have a real vision of where they want to carry us as a species. That they consider us to be a pile of algorithms. A human being amounts to code, which means that as we become further cyborg, it's really just the natural course of human evolution. Mark Zuckerberg talks about how we'll become better people if we have less secrets. If you present the same person who you are in private as you do in the office, then you're going to become a much more virtuous human being. Because there's integrity to having a self that is consistent. And what I found in total was that Silicon Valley likes to masquerade as being libertarian, and there are a lot of libertarians there, and they do hate certain pieces of government. But deep down, there is this yearning within technology to have the world be stitched into one, for the world to be collectivized in a way. And you hear it in the rhetoric that media is social, that the network is everything, that we need to be crowdsourced and collaborative. And it's this yearning for one that makes Silicon Valley so deeply insensitive to individualism and individuality. It's the reason that they roll privacy, that they have so little respect for our ideas about authorship and why they've waged war on intellectual property. It's the reason why they want us to outsource as many decisions in the course of a day to their algorithms and their machines, thus surrendering our free will. It's the reason why they view monopoly as the platonic state of capitalism as opposed to the competitive economy that's really necessary in the end for preserving individualism and individuality. And so the point is that these companies have amassed incredible economic power. And that economic power is leveraged not just to hijack our attention and addict us to those machines, it's to point us in the direction of human nature that they view as ideal for us. And human beings have always had technology. Tools are among the things that define us as a species. And I have no I think Google, the search engine, is a wonder of human ingenuity. It's one of the greatest tributes to human creativity. The iPhone is a flat out amazing feat of engineering. But the problem is that these technologies with their magical qualities shouldn't cause us to suspend skepticism. They shouldn't cause us to just succumb to the magic. And when we're merging with these machines, we're not just merging with the machines, we're merging with the companies that operate the machines. And so my book is a plea for us to reclaim agency in the face of all this, that it's so easy for us to succumb to a future where we just say, these changes are inevitable. It's inevitable that we give up privacy. It's inevitable that we have this network economy that's dominated by a few corporations. But what's at stake in this debate is so great. The reason I call it existential is because the very qualities that define us as human beings could disappear in this transformation. So rather than simply accept that as our fate as a species, I think it's important that we subject these companies to the toughest questions, that we try to create an architecture for the human future that protects the things that we deem to be important. So why don't we have a talk?
Great stuff. Zuckerberg is right, though, isn't he? Quite interestingly, there's been a whole series of articles in The Atlantic tracking the impact of smartphone and smart technology on particularly young people. And one of the interesting trends, of course, is that more virtuous behavior is abounding amongst today's adolescents. I mean, compared to my generation, I guess our generation and our parents' generation.
It depends what you count as virtuous behavior and whether you regard virtuous behavior as being a net social good.
Yeah.
So what you're describing is also a world of increased loneliness, and there's evidence of greater depression. So kids may not be having sex, but they're not necessarily happy.
The moral majority had it wrong. They should have just given everyone a smartphone, and that would have been fine, right?
Yeah, right.
But no, you're right. But we'll come back to those very negative impacts, because they're very real later on in the conversation. It seems to me, I think, you know, the book is profoundly interesting and important in terms of that reclaiming agency conversation. I think we have to have these conversations about what the real impacts are. I want to sort of reflect on the companies themselves a little,
sure.
Because it seems to me there's something profoundly dangerous in institutions or companies or organizations finding themselves on a sense of moral virtue, where that's almost their first foot forward into the world. And so therefore, we are virtuous, therefore we are virtuous. And I just wonder whether you sense that the foundation principles, and you talk about Stuart Brand and Whole Earth Catalog and this unity and this sort of Grateful Dead communalism, if you like, has prevented some of the self-critique in the early years of these companies that might have led them down a different path in terms of the impacts they might have been able to have.
Right. Well, let me just step back for a moment and say one of the fascinating things about the history of technology is that it took place in the peninsula just south of San Francisco. And so you had this incredible accident where you had the Grateful Dead, LSD, the counterculture happening at the same time as the creation of Apple Computer and the internet. And the two things rubbed up against one another. I don't think you could have had this technological revolution without the idealism of the counterculture, which helped fuel a lot of the truly heterodox ideas that allowed these West Coast companies to break free of the previous generation of tech, which was concentrated in the bureaucratic old East Coast. Yeah. And so one of the aspirations was that you had hundreds of thousands of people decamping in the late 60s and early 70s to communes. And so this idea of oneness and wholeness that I talked about was actually baked into some of the initial ideas about technology, which was trying to succeed where the counterculture had failed in creating new consciousness. And so your question is whether that idealism somehow renders these companies less self-aware.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think it does two things. One is it accounts for their huge ambitions.
Yes.
And it's their huge ambitions which I think do lead them to almost a cult-like theological pursuit of their goals, which means that they're insensitive. So a classic example would be Google's rush to digitize every book before they'd sorted out the copyright laws. And so most people, the idea of going to, quietly going into libraries at night and secretly taking out boxes of books and scanning them in a way in which you were trying, they were trying to, it's Google.
Rules are coming in next.
Yeah. To do that in such a surreptitious way where they assumed that there wouldn't, you know, whatever consequences would happen, they would deal with because they were trivial in the face of their grand ambitions. I think that does mean that they can seem hubristic.
Yeah, interesting. It's just something. I was actually in Silicon Valley a few weeks ago, and I was sat in a restaurant. I was by myself, and I was inevitably eavesdropping to the conversation next to me. And it was two guys, and one was saying to the other, "You know, I'm motivated by art." He said, "I'm motivated by the art of life. Everything I've done in commerce and business has been about art." And then he flipped out his laptop, and he said, "And here is the $3 billion house I'm going to buy on the coast next to San Diego with my bonus." And I just thought, hold on a minute. There's not a lot of art in this. Yeah. This is still the same sort of, you know, baby boomer generation X right. materialism here.
Right. By art, I mean making gobs of money.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So what in your view, I mean, you've outlined, you know, a particular perspective on how the digital revolution has evolved. What would a good digital revolution have looked like for you?
So another interesting confluence was that the internet began as initially the property of the Defense Department, and then it was handed over to the National Science Foundation, and it was run as a government regulated body until the late 80s, early 90s, when it was privatized.
Yes.
And it was privatized in a world where we were coming, there was the euphoria of the Cold War, markets had their greatest prestige, regulation was kind of at a low point in the way that at least elites considered it. And so the internet was deliberately created without rules.
Yes.
Now you could say on the one hand, the lack of rules was part of what allowed things to flourish. But on the other hand, I think we've been especially slow to establish rules. And so, and this happens with every single technology, right? So you have automobiles go on the road, and initially you have a lot of crashes, and then we put up stop signs, and we create speed limits, and we force them to install safety belts, and we start to harness that new technology in a way that better respects certain human imperatives. And so I would have loved, in retrospect, and even going forward, I think that we need to be able to create a digital future that manages to preserve privacy.
Yes.
That privacy, we have such little understanding of why privacy is important.
Yes.
And we seem so eager to just rush to whatever the free product is.
Yes.
Can I just riff about privacy for a minute?
Go for it.
So we tell things to these machines that we would never tell to another human being. And we just assume that sanctity of our relationship with that machine will be protected. And we have no idea what a world would look like when all those secrets exploded into the open. But I've actually seen the future, and the future is The Office. Not the show, but actually the way that workplaces exist. So once upon a time, when I started out, there were doors on offices, and you could walk into an office and you could have a conversation with a friend and or a colleague. And you would tell them whatever idea you were considering, but it was in the sanctity of that office. You knew you could say something stupid, and that would be okay, and it was in the service of hatching ideas. But now there are no walls in offices, and conversation happens on platforms like Slack, where you're messaging people all the time. And so if you have an idea, you think to yourself, wait, this is probably a stupid idea, and if I say it, I'm saying it in public, and I could be shamed for this idea, or I could look like an idiot in front of my friends, so I'm just going to withhold that idea to myself. And so when everything is on stage, we become flattened, we become cautious, we become less transgressive.
Or do we construct very different types of spaces? I'm sure my team have a whole series of WhatsApp groups. I'm not in any of them, I know for a fact. And that's where they construct their private conversations and achieves exactly the same thing, but in a different format. Is it truly different from knocking on the door?
I think that there are possibilities for that type of semi-private conversation. Yes. I think the expectations are probably of privacy are probably greater than the reality.
Right.
But I do. There are forces that drive that office conversation to these platforms where it's considered. It's not just considered kind of an improvisational part of the ideas generation process. It's considered kind of actual requirement of participation in a workplace community.
Yeah. Okay. Good. There's quite a lot in your book around old media, which you have obviously a very strong attachment to. And I just wonder, I mean, this might be quite a UK-specific observation, but I wonder whether you might overstate the virtue of old media. And we come from an environment here where two or three of the biggest scandals in the last 20 years have involved major media companies of different types. There's been incredible intrusion into privacy. Very hostile politics, crossing over this division between news and opinion in a very manipulative way. Not as targeted as some of the stuff that happens on Facebook, but nonetheless is deliberately designed to provoke fear and response and agitate. And that's been much of the media environment that we've existed in for a quarter of a century. And there's very powerful people who are behind all that, are very wealthy people with political opinion. They're not neutral players in all of this. So I just wonder whether there is a risk of over-romanticizing the old media culture. There was some wonderful investigative reporting within that, of course, and some incredible news values. I don't want to detract from any of that, but do you think you might over-egg it a bit in terms of the old media virtue?
So my kind of yearning in the book is really for there to be some common basis for fact. And in that regard, there are crucial differences between, I think, the American media environment and the UK media environment. And the UK media environment has generally skewed in a more partisan sort of way.
In the newsprint, but not necessarily.
And not necessarily
on TV.
Right, not necessarily on TV.
Yeah.
And ironically, because you have state media, you probably have a little bit more of a common basis for fact than we do in the United States, where state media is treated kind of as some sort of hostile foreign possibility that shall never be considered. So in the United States, I mean, what I was trying to do in the book was to contrast old conceptions of gatekeeping with new conceptions of gatekeeping. Yeah. And so the idea is, in a democracy, information has to flow. It's always flowing through gates. There's always somebody there who's making decisions about what's important and what's not important.
Yeah.
And in the United States, it was this ethos of gatekeeping that felt at least some measure of responsibility. There was this, it was almost a noblesse oblige, and it was phony in probably ways that would be intensely familiar to people here.
Where might have that phoniness, and there's a hint of it. You kind of think that's an important sort of sustaining myth.
Right. So right, there are all sorts of lies that we tell ourselves that we know are lies, but are also useful. So the idea of objectivity in media, we know is impossible, that you will always be hindered by whatever bias you bring to the table. You'll always be hindered by some sort of commercial imperative that's interfering with your work. But on the other hand, the alternative to a world where you don't consider the possibility of fact to be achievable results in this kind of kind of war of attrition, where you just throw out whatever conspiracy, whatever falsehood, and you hope it sticks.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. We're British, we're very used to lying to ourselves, so it's that's what we're very comfortable with.
I think the lies we tell ourselves are in the United States are pretty damn good too.
And getting better, some might say. So I mean, going back to your analogy of eating healthy eating and junk food and making ourselves sick, I mean, it's undeniably true that there is an incredible amount of junk that's available that whizzes past our eyeballs every day, and some of it sticks and some of it doesn't. But there's a lot more quality out there as well. And I'm thinking specifically around, you know, the newsprint and the type of things that we tend to access now that 10 years ago we would have accessed, but in far less frequently. And you know, a publication I read extremely regularly actually is Atlantic, you know, the New Yorker, London Review of Books, New York Review of Books. It goes on, and you know, any quality journalism has a way of finding you. And actually, there are a lot of publications that have made that journey from the offline world into a very effective digital space where there is now a global audience for high-quality journalism and new publications, online publications such as Vox and so on. Are we missing the sort of access to quality blinded by the noise of the junk?
Well, there's no doubt. Even so, one of the paragons of the new era is BuzzFeed.
Yeah.
And BuzzFeed represents to me both the possibilities of the new era and the perils of the new era. So BuzzFeed has published some of the most important investigative pieces of the 21st century. But BuzzFeed has also revolutionized media to become much more data-driven and has produced kind of epic new levels of crap that also suggest kind of the future. And so it's a bit at war with itself, but I think that even in the quality publications where quality manages to persist, you have this dependence on the platform. Yeah. And it's that dependence on the platform that kind of erodes at the integrity and the soul of the even those institutions that you're describing. And I've seen it up close in the ways in which something like the Washington Post or the New York Times or, dare I say, the Guardian continues to publish very good things, but there's also this kind of rush to publish the popular and this kind of break into there is a trade-off that even the quality things are produced in a way that are designed to be popular.
Yes.
And so who can argue with that? Good and popular is exactly what we should strive for in the world. But the pursuit of popularity also leads you away from certain subjects. So it's, you know, you don't report about the Rohingya until Rohingya becomes, you know, somehow, you know, it becomes a crisis and then becomes a trending thing. And of course, that's a little bit the way the world works in general, which is that you don't pay attention to something until it becomes a crisis. But every piece of journalism now is subjected to a cost-benefit analysis before it's assigned. You don't, once upon a time, we used to think about issues of a newspaper or issues of a magazine, and now it's all been disaggregated into each of its component parts.
Yes.
And we can track how each of those component parts win or lose. And maybe something that's not popular can win an award and it'll be redeemed in the eyes of the news organization. But if something, if you produce something on a worthy subject and it doesn't sell online, then it's regarded as a failure. And that becomes a pattern that informs future decisions.
Okay. The final question, and we'll open it out to the audience. But the remedies, and you know, quite naturally, you reach back towards sort of antitrust, and there's a history in the book of the evolution of antitrust towards consumer rights, mm-hmm. as opposed to deconcentration of power. Obviously, you look at regulatory responses as well, and the sort of impacts that we're talking about, from health to communal to societal to the state and health of democracy, which obviously is an acute concern given what has been experienced in recent times. Do you think reaching back for some of those 20th century remedies can ultimately be the right response. Did you feel that actually you had to reach back for those sorts of remedies because that's what was there and what we know and what we've seen has had some impact in the past? Or do you think, and I'm not asking you to answer, you know, what the creative new methods might be, or do you think we as political communities have to rethink how we approach firms which are natural monopolies in many ways, and even if you split them up, for example, they'd still be natural monopolies. You might not be able to tax them in the way that you wanted. The regulatory authorities might never be able to have the powers that would enable effective and agile regulation. What's the conversation we should be having?
Well, so my hope is that we don't just go back and take an 1890s law and apply it to the present, but that our antitrust laws need to be updated to take account of the novel nature of these new corporations. So in the United States for the last 60 years, we can only see the harm of a corporation if it jacked up prices or used explicitly bullying behavior. But you look at these companies, the products are free. Amazon has objectively low prices. If you're out after efficiency, again, hard to quibble with these corporations, which have ushered in new levels of efficiency. But when it comes to protecting democratic values, that once upon a time was at the core of our concern about monopoly. Yeah. And so when I reach backwards, I'm not reaching backwards in order to get the remedies that were applied in 1910. I'm reaching backwards in order to try to restore values to the center of our competition policy. In terms of remedies, there are two things. One is there's a lot that we can, it seems to me without fundamentally remaking technology, there's a lot that we can do to impose the sorts of rules that made the equivalent of the rules that made automobiles safe. Yes. So it's gobsmacking that there's so few data protections. In the United States, there is no data protection law. Your health records are protected, your financial records are protected, but there's no paradigm for protecting data. And it seems to me we need to shift our thinking about data. And companies act as if they own the data, but really, data is much closer to a public good than something that the companies own. And I think we need to move to a world in which it's treated like the environment, where companies are able to degrade the environment to a certain extent in order to make profit, but within a regulatory framework that forces them to protect the public good at core. Yes. I do think that competition policy can change in order to take account of privacy, but also it's not even a matter of dismembering companies, although I think I favor dismembering some of these companies. But it's about creating space for future competitors. And there's a real proud tradition of especially as the technology evolves so rapidly, where as new technologies come online, where you don't permit these companies to simply buy the next advantage. So right now, these companies, if you're a startup in Silicon Valley, your aspiration is to get bought by Facebook, Google, Amazon, or Apple. If you're in the field of virtual reality, say, or you're in artificial intelligence, these companies are sitting on top of monopolistic rents, which means that they can spend lavishly on locking up the talent that would potentially create the startup that would challenge these groups. And then finally, I just would be remiss if I didn't talk about what we can do as individuals. And that clearly there are, so as individuals, we permit ourselves to be addicted to these technologies. And in part, we're benefiting from the efficiency and we're enjoying the fruits of these corporations. But knowing that so much of the product is addictive and is designed to be addictive, we need to learn how to practice some form of moderation when it comes to them. Food is addictive, drink can be addictive, yet we teach our children ways in which they can use these within reason. And so we don't sit around gorging all day long. we are able to eat in like small increments over the course of a day. We don't allow it to dominate our lives and to destroy our health. And so It's hard because the forces arrayed against us are so powerful. But we shouldn't act as if we're powerless in the face of them.
And sending out a powerful public signal could be very important. Okay, let's... wow. That was quick. I'm going to take this lady here, this gentleman here, and I'll take this gentleman. I'll start off with this side of the room, and I might try and fan over.
Sorry, I had a question, because you had some solutions of what governments could potentially do. These individuals could do, and perhaps probably platforms themselves. But I was wondering what particularly journalistic powerhouses like the New York Times, et cetera, could do to sort of break this platform dependency dynamic. Thank you for the talk.
Also. Thank you.
So it's interesting. Should we take
three?
Okay, please.
I just want to pick up on Anthony's point, and we have a saying, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Mm-hmm. If you want to go to Russia and you want a visa, you have to tell them which social media accounts you belong to. Now, that tells me the benefit versus the disadvantage of commercial exploitation. So I'm baby in bathwater.
Okay, great, Frank. Thank you. And then there's just a gentleman here.
I'm a retired teacher and a fellow. I spent 40 years trying to understand how children could realise the truth. We seem to have young people who are influenced by this big technology in a great way, and yet our curriculum and our national curriculum is forcing them to learn facts and regurgitate them, seemingly unnecessarily. What do you think the curriculum in terms of knowledge and skills should be to allow children to somehow navigate this future with some kind of integrity?
Yeah. Got this?
Okay. So, first question was, what can journalism do? And I think it's interesting that journalism has suffered from a collective action problem where everybody has realized that they are overly dependent on Facebook, yet there's been fearfulness in the face of Facebook's power, so a reluctance to try to pry themselves away from this state of dependence. Ironically, the Trump election has changed a lot. It's brought attention on some of the harms that have come with Facebook. And so it's been interesting to watch. The New York Times now every day publishes a piece about why Silicon Valley is terrible, which is kind of both good and bad for the sake of my own timing. I mean, but never mind. So I think that journalism needs to have a sense of self-confidence and about the underlying worth of its product. And in the end, a world where journalism is entirely dependent on digital advertising is a world that's not sustainable for journalism. And so we've seen outlets make tentative steps back in the direction of subscriptions, which I think is important. This is gonna also sound mad, but I think that ad blocking is a tremendous opportunity for journalism. I wish it had taken off a little bit quicker than it has, but I think this current ad model just needs to be broken in order for something fresh to arise in its wake. And so the next question was about...
commercial entities, don't throw the baby out of the bathwater, thinking about privacy and a space away from the state, as an authoritarian state.
I quite agree, which is why I would there's a lot of calls right now to create, at least in the United States, to regulate Facebook like a utility, which I think is a horrible idea. I don't want government creating the rules that govern the way in which a platform like Facebook would operate. But I also see the reverse of what you were describing, which is that I see the ways in which the Russians are exploiting our democracy in order to achieve their aims, and they're doing it through these mediums. And they're doing it a lot more effectively than Facebook is changing Russia, unfortunately.
And then what does the education of the future look like? What should we value in education? Thinking about your own values and talking about truth and facts, and obviously there is a big conversation and dialogue about whether you should move from sort of knowledge-based curriculums into something that's wider. What should the education of the future look like, given your perspective?
So I've thought about this in the context of my own daughter, and so much about technology we see refracted back to us by our children, right? So that there are levels of addiction that we suffer in ourselves that we're just incapable of seeing. So when we sit there in the course of conversation, swiping or ignoring the person we're in conversation with, we're unself-aware of that. But when we see our kids sitting around texting, we'll hector them to put the phone down. So they're two things that I think we need to explain that are, first is, well, there are many things we need to explain to our kids, but one of which is I think it's actually important to explain to them the addictive natures of these technologies so that that self-awareness is nurtured at a very early stage. Something I stumbled into with my own kids is that we watched a documentary that Katie Couric did in the United States about childhood obesity called Fed Up. And it was about the addictive nature of food and how that evolved over time. And so when I was able to explain to them that their phones were created in the same sort of way, that was especially terrifying to them. But secondly, I think we're still locked in a bit of a two cultures sort of debate, going back to the famous C.P. Snow framework for science versus the humanities. And a lot of the problems that I see with these companies has to do with the fact that they were created by engineers with an engineering mindset where efficiency was the end of the system, and the human dimensions of the system just escape them. You see this with Zuckerberg constantly in the way that he talks about things and the way in which he just seems incapable of understanding why people don't appreciate the beauty of this thing that he's rigged up. And so my daughter, who is 12, is magnetically drawn to coding and to computer science. And my initial instinct as a humanities person is to say, go be a poet, go be a philosopher. But as I've turned it over and as I've thought about this, what the world needs are actually computer scientists who are also humanists. And we need to find a curriculum that does a better way of stitching the two things together and that understands that so much of this world is about designing systems. And a system can only be a good system if it has an ethical foundation, if it understands the nature of politics and political disagreements, if it understands the value of words, which are so ultimately devalued in the systems that I'm describing in this book.
I worry about the ability of the state to devise curriculums that do that, because always the temptation is to go for what's efficient in terms of the specialization of the future. So we need a public educational conversation.
Right. But it's, you know, so much of this is also takes place within universities, which have their own esoteric provincial reasons for structuring things the way that they do.
Great. So I'm going to take this lady here, continuing my sweep across the room. Then I'm going to take this gentleman here, and I'm going to take this one right here. And then I'm going to continue going to the right.
Well, I would like to follow on education, because I understand the House of Lords now is advocating child computer interfaces that would, after 2 hours, ask children to just switch the computer off and go and play outside. Now, my grandson is 9 and a half and he's already addicted to Minecraft. So I said, well, look, before long, there will be this interface that will stop you. Oh, so what? I will switch it on again. No, you won't be able to switch it on because it won't allow you. So what? I'll hack it. Hack it, yes. Now, given that our scores.
Can I draw you to a question, please? Sorry.
Sorry?
Can I just draw you to a question, please?
Yeah, the question, yes, we'll follow up from the story.
not a story, a question.
The question is, if all people are trained now in coding and programming, and think of hacking in positive terms, what would that do the control of what's happening with technology and how it affects us?
Thank you. Okay, then it was this gentleman here.
It seems that the post-truth society is fed on post-modernism. And the post-truth society that we've entered today, or the so-called post-truth society, seems to have drawn a lot on post-modernism and how history is written, who's written out, who's written into it, and all that. And I'm wondering, with 5 billion more people getting electronically hooked from countries of the world which are outside the Western world, do you see a new approach to their understanding of this adding to, contributing to a better understanding of the dangers?
Great. Thank you very much. And then this one here. Yes.
Thanks. Have you experienced a backlash from companies if they feel threatened by what you're saying? Because it feels scary to take on the problem of data when we feel dependent, when we are dependent on them to communicate about it.
Okay. So hacking and its consequences.
So, I share so many of your anxieties that I feel like you want there to be times where your kids are switched off, where they experience, but I also think back on my own addiction to television when I was a kid, right? And I don't have a great answer for you to your question. I can relate something that my parents did that I think is really I found in retrospect incredibly beneficial, which is my parents gave me and my brothers a credit card, which they said could only be used in the case of emergency, with one exception, which is that we had a neighborhood bookstore, and they said we could spend at will there. And so they created structures for us that encouraged reading. And I don't want to, in general, in society, I look at a lot of, obviously I wrote an apocalyptic book, it's called World Without Mind. It's about an existential threat. One thing that makes me very pleased is I look at what's happened to books. That when the ebook was debuted, when the Kindle first came online, people date stamped the death of books. They said, they predicted that in the year 2015, there would be no more paper books. And that didn't seem like such a wild prediction to make then. And lo and behold, ebook sales have basically plateaued, and paper book sales tick up a little bit each year. And so there is, I think, something within all of us that kind of doesn't like, it's subconscious. We don't like living on screens all day. We don't like being notified all the time. We don't like to be dinged and pinged. We want there to be some moments where we step out of the system, where we're able to contemplate, and we're able to tend to ourselves. And so I'm gonna tell you the most trite piece of advice, which is do everything in your power to incentivize the reading of paper books as an antidote to everything else. I mean, there's no reason why those two things should be mutually exclusive. A kid who loves Minecraft should also be able to love reading a novel or reading history. Well, unfortunately, I guess my book kind of says there'll be four companies.
So this point about 5 billion new holders of connected technology.
I'm concerned about the ways in which, so you have one example, which is Facebook has been so aggressive in as creating even a nonprofit arm that's designed to give cheap technology to the large parts of the unconnected world to make them connected. But part of the peril is that you see that a lot of this mode of connection is done in a way to create it, to create connection just to Facebook, where the internet becomes only Facebook, and Facebook becomes the primary connection to consumption, to news and information. And so that definitely concerns me. But you know, on balance, I'll repeat what I've said before, which is that we're balancing two things. Connection is important to being a member of a global community. There's incredible emancipatory power that comes with the internet. But the danger is when all that power is concentrated within a couple units.
And has there been a backlash from the Big Four?
Has there been a backlash from the Big Four? Well, I've heard from some of the companies who there's varying degrees of savvy within the companies. I would say that there's, for instance, Google. I've heard from the most, and they seem more interested in engaging with my arguments. Facebook seems to be kind of caught unawares of the backlash that it's facing more broadly. And my book is the least of their problems right now. But what we see in general with these three companies is that Google, Facebook, and Amazon right now especially, they're making massive investments in lobbying and in public relations. And we used to think of them as being different kinds of companies who didn't have to rely on that kind of those conventional techniques of corporate power, but because of the force of the backlash that they're now experiencing around the globe, they're having to circle back and behave just like every other corporation in Washington or Brussels or London.
I'm afraid I've deployed a discriminatory algorithm, and I've cut off this side of the room from questions because we've run out of time, and we could have carried on for another half an hour at least. I'd highly recommend the book. Brilliantly written, very observant, personal experience, as well as deep insight on the consequences of certain ways of doing things in a digital world, World Without Mind. Thank you very much, Frank.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews, and animations.